From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, is being homeless a crime? What's happening in some Texas cities? The destruction of Hurricane Harvey continues to rule some Texas coastal communities. And is the Texas National Guard listening to your cell phone conversations? They've got the tech to do it. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Several cities in Texas and across the country have laws in place that penalize sleeping, loitering, and begging in public. Cities and police say these laws are necessary for public health and safety. Others say they unfairly target the homeless. For them, sleeping and sitting in the streets is part of life. As part of KERA's One Crisis Away, which explores life on the financial edge, Stephanie Kuo talked to experts who say these laws actually keep the homeless on the streets.
Once a year, the Dallas Association of Young Lawyers and the Stewpot Downtown host community court. It's an opportunity for homeless people to trade in tickets for community service. Tickets for riding DART trains and buses without paying, for jaywalking, loitering, relatively minor offenses. It's 8 on a chilly Saturday morning, and dozens are already lined up outside.
All right, hey, y'all be patient with us, and thanks for being here. And we're going to get you lined up. It's going to be a really good day for everybody, all right?
Steve Sider is a justice of the peace in Dallas County and has volunteered for the past 17 years to help homeless people wipe their slates clean.
It became obvious that there was an impediment to folks getting their IDs or driver's license with holds because of open tickets. They couldn't get services or access to jobs. So it's really started to, as the first step in hopefully a journey where folks are going to be able to clean up their record and move on down the road.
Moving forward is exactly what 52-year-old Michael Walton wants to do.
I'll be riding the train most of the time. That'll keep you, like, warm.
He says he's got a few tickets for fare evasion on DART, and they weigh on him constantly.
When you're homeless, you worry about a whole lot. Sleep, where you're going to eat the next day, you know, how you're going to get here, how you're going to get there. If you get the tickets taken care of, that's a good thing. Police stop you and say, oh, yeah, man, I'm clear. Make you feel good. If you got a ticket, you're like, don't take me to jail. I got a ticket.
So in return for your plea, you'll do some community service here this morning. They'll get it all taken care of for you, okay?
But even after today, Walton and the others at this court run the risk of racking up more tickets. They'll hop on a train to see a doctor or get to a job, and they'll get issued a citation for fare evasion. Try to get that ticket sorted out and get another ticket on the way, and that cycle continues. So community courts like the one at the Stewpot have been helpful. But there are several other laws on the books that the homeless can front every day.
Laws that make it a crime to sleep in public places, to sit down, to lie down in public places.
Maria Foscarinas is the executive director of the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty.
To loiter, to beg or panhandle, to essentially be in public.
The group has been tracking these types of ordinances for the past 10 years across nearly 200 cities. And Foscarina says there's been an increase. Laws that penalize sleeping in cars have gone up 140%. Bans on sitting or lying down in public have increased by 52%. And bans on loitering up 88%. All of this amounts to what homeless advocates call the criminalization of homelessness.
When we use that term, we refer to efforts to make it a crime to do things that are otherwise innocent, necessary human behaviors that people who are homeless have no choice but to do in public places.
In Dallas, the police can stop you if you're loitering or panhandling in certain public places at certain times, and it's considered a crime to sleep or doze anywhere in public. But there aren't enough emergency shelter beds across the city, and many homeless people feel they have no choice but to sleep or be outside. According to municipal court data, Dallas police issued more than 11,000 sleeping in public citations from 2012 to 2015. 2,000 citations for panhandling in 2015 alone. These are $150 to $300 tickets that often go unpaid and could lead to jail time. Foscarinas calls it a vicious cycle.
They exacerbate the pain and misery of living on the street, of being homeless, but they also make it harder to exit homelessness because they saddle people with a criminal record. And then that makes it hard to get a job or housing or even public benefits.
These are tickets that even police will admit don't make sense financially.
Homelessness is not against the law. I mean, we cannot arrest our way out of this problem. It has to be done another way.
Dave Hogan heads the Crisis Intervention Unit with the Dallas Police Department. He says all those tickets over the past few years has cost the city a lot in time, resources, and manpower. He's a social worker and knows that policing the homeless from a place of empathy is often more effective. That means instead of whipping out the ticket book, encouraging and helping a homeless person get into a shelter or find needed services has become the overriding policy at Dallas Police.
We really look at what is it going to take when you're standing in front of somebody who is homeless and they're telling you the problem they have. What is it going to take to get that person out of homelessness?
For some, it's better access to mental health resources. Maria Foscarina says for most, it's a home.
We can all agree that having people living in public places is not a good thing. Where we disagree with cities is what do you do about it? We feel that solving the problem through permanent affordable housing is the way to go.
And that seems to be the position Dallas has taken in the past year since it shut down Tent City, the 300-person homeless camp under Interstate 45. This month, Dallas voters passed a $20 million bond that'll go toward permanent and transitional housing for the homeless. That means good things for people like Michael Walton, who's slept on trains or in private hideouts on the street for the past 5 years. He has some leads on an apartment.
No, I don't like nobody around me, no stealing from me, messing with me. I'm going to be a quiet person, just be in a quiet spot. So if I can get my own spot and my own place, it made me feel much, much better.
That's a chance for Walton to break the cycle. The cycle in which he's getting the same tickets and coming back to the same community court every year because he has nowhere else to go. Stephanie Kuo, KERA News.
It was about 85 days ago that Hurricane Harvey made landfall on the Texas coast. The Category 4 storm ravaged the coastal bend, leaving homes, businesses, and public facilities in ruin. Today, many people remain homeless, living in tents, cars, and in hotel rooms. Last week, the Texas House Appropriations Subcommittee on Disaster Impact and Recovery held a hearing in Corpus Christi. They heard from a number of local mayors and county officials about their needs. But the testimony of Port Aransas Mayor Charles Bouillon was particularly moving.
My name is Charles Bouillon, and I'm mayor of the city of Port Aransas. As you are aware, well aware, I'm sure, on August 25th, Hurricane Harvey devastated our town, almost 90%. Over 80% of our residents and businesses suffered major damage or total loss. We just yesterday added 34 more homes to a long list of homes that have to be demolished. For a tourist economy like ours, this hurricane was perhaps the total disaster that you never want to happen. Our school system suffered great damage. All of our campuses are inoperable. One of our campuses totally destroyed and has to be rebuilt. All of our students had to start school late, and as a matter of fact, last month. They are now all in trailers going to school. The project worksheets that we've started to submit to FEMA currently total in this building $47 million. In damages to just city facilities alone. This list continues to grow. Our fire equipment and fire department suffered major damage, major equipment damage. Our public works building was completely destroyed with most of the vehicles. Our EMS and police and constable and court municipal building is totally destroyed. Our library is destroyed and all of the books in it. Our marina is not usable and completely 80% destroyed. We lost 40 vessels in the harbor alone, and we're still in the process of looking for vessels that are under the water. Our 12,000-acre nature preserve was heavily damaged with all the walkways gone. It was the bulkheads that protect it along the Corpus Christi ship channel were breached in three places. And so we now have channels that cut into the island that's only about 2 miles wide to begin with. Our piers were all destroyed. One was partially left, our fishing piers, with over 90% of our city facilities either destroyed or inoperable. It's going to be critical for us to rebuild those structures in a manner that will reduce future disaster impacts. And for our city, we have looked at this as something that we absolutely need to do. We need to elevate our buildings to at least 15 feet, all of our city facility buildings. We need to build a 20 by land and build a 20-foot high storage area for all of our equipment. We need to find a way to protect our piers. They were built out of concrete, but when you have a hurricane like Harvey with winds upwards of 151 miles an hour, concrete doesn't do the trick either. So we need to look at that, ways to keep those piers intact in hurricanes of winds of upward of 160 to 200 miles an hour. We need to change our ordinances in our city, and we intend to do that, to exclude any homes being built on slabs. All must be elevated in the future. It's also important for you to know that the University of Texas Marine Science Institute, that is located on the island, is the largest employer in Port Aransas. Its research is so important to the health of our coastal waters and fishery. To lose that is a catastrophe. They suffered over $100 million in damage. Our city needs help. We are a resilient people. We live by the sea. We understand the ramifications of the power of that sea. We have suffered many storms, but nothing like Hurricane Harvey. This storm has dealt us a deadly blow. As mayor, I'm reaching out to you on this panel and this state government for assistance. And far as housing goes, we have many people who are without homes. We have people living in tents. We have people living in the sand dunes. We have people living in motels. We have people, I just had one in my office yesterday that walks the street at night because her home was destroyed. She has no place to go, and FEMA turned them down for housing assistance. I'm very disappointed, and I'll be honest with you, because I have to face the people who suffered the most daily in my office. One by one, they come. I'm very disappointed that we, as a city of 3,900 people, received a direct hit from the eye wall of a hurricane with winds sustained at 130 miles an hour for over 6 hours. And at the peak of the hurricane, they increased to 150 miles an hour. And when they increased to 150 miles an hour and the wind turned to the north-northwest, we received an 11-foot tsunami that went across our island and in our homes and destroyed everything. I'm very disappointed that we have received absolutely nothing from the state of Texas in terms of funds. And I want to be honest with you. And Frank, absolutely zero. Port Aransas that received a direct hit, Aransas Pass that received a direct hit, Rockport that received a direct hit from a powerful hurricane, zilch. That's not right. We need help. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mayor.
Charles Bouillon is the mayor of Port Aransas. He testified to the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Disaster Impact and Recovery at a hearing on November 8th. The Texas National Guard has purchased new technology that gives them the ability to listen to cell phone conversations and read all text being sent in a given area. An investigation by the Texas Observer found that the Texas National Guard is using snooping gear in Texas without warrants or oversight, and they're picking up conversations of innocent Texans along the way. Melissa Del Bosque is a reporter for the Texas Observer.
These are cell phone surveillance devices that can be used by land or by air. And what the Texas National Guard has done is installed these dirt boxes in two of their surveillance planes. And what the technology does is it mimics a cell phone tower. So when they're trying to locate a fugitive below, they're zeroing in on the fugitive's cell phone to track him or her, but they're also scooping up everybody else's cell phone data as well. And the issue here is if they're military, which they are, you know, how do you get a warrant? They're not law enforcement. So, I mean, this type of surveillance is pretty controversial. Typically, you need a judicial warrant to use it. So there's a lot of questions, basically, and of course, the Texas National Guard is not talking publicly about how they're using this technology.
The dirt boxes, that's slang for the digital receiver technology. That's what we're talking about. We've heard about stingrays before. How does this compare to that?
This technology is supposed to be a little bit more powerful than the stingrays, and honestly, it's hard to know. The companies are very private. They have a lot of law enforcement signed non-disclosure agreements, so they can't talk too much about the technology. But the DRT, their technology, is supposed to be especially powerful. You know, they can listen in on phone conversations and intercept text messages and photos, and they can record or listen in real time to phone calls.
What are they doing with this information? Not just the information of the individual that they're targeting, but all of the information that they're scooping up along the way.
Well, that's what we don't know, and that's a big question in the story, is what is being done with the information? What type of information are they collecting? How are they retaining it? How are they using it? How are they protecting innocent Texans who have nothing to do with any type of criminal activity from having their, you know, personal information from their cell phone scooped up in one of these, and privacy advocates will refer to these as digital dragnets, because the technology is so powerful that it just scoops up, you know, everybody's cell phone information within a certain radius.
What is that radius?
I think it's up to a third of a mile.
So this is basically dark information that they're able to gather. They're able to use maybe for operations, but not for prosecution.
Well, I mean, they may be using it for prosecution. We really don't know. They're working in they're working in tandem with the Drug Enforcement Administration, with the DEA. So we don't know if the DEA is bringing cases to prosecutors with, you know, information that was gathered through the surveillance. And we don't know really how the National Guard is working in tandem with the DEA.
Information that they scoop up along the way. I might just be happening to live next door to a guy or a stash house and not even know it. They're picking up all of my cell phone stuff. Is that being recorded and held indefinitely, or is that being discarded as they go since I'm not the target?
See, that's what we don't know. We have no idea. I mean, they could be listening in real time. They could be recording it. You know, how long, if they're recording it, how long are they retaining it for? How do they sift out the fugitive from all of the innocent people's data that's around that fugitive? I mean, there's just a lot of questions that are unanswered. And I thought in our story, you know, we talked to Cesar Blanco, who's a state representative, and he's a former Navy intelligence analyst, and he's also vice chairman of the Texas House Committee that oversees the National Guard. And he was unaware that these purchases had been made. And as a former intelligence officer himself, he was very sort of taken aback, because he knows how powerful this technology is. And he suggested that he would be interested in creating a committee of oversight for intelligence use and surveillance use in the state, similar to what they do at the federal level, because at this point, surveillance is so pervasive, so pervasively used by law enforcement at this point that we really have no idea who's using what, to what degree. You know, do we have any privacy left? There are a lot of questions that have not been answered that he was saying he'd like to create a committee to oversee these types of programs.
The state rep, Cesar Blanco, he says he didn't know that they had this technology?
No, he wasn't aware that they had purchased that cell phone surveillance technology. And I think it's something that's, you know, over the years continued to concern him. And so I thought that was an interesting suggestion that he's making to start a committee in the Texas legislature that would oversee these types of programs, or at least have an idea of how they're being used and, you know, if our privacy is being protected.
If a law enforcement agency was able to obtain this type of technology, would they have to get a warrant and demonstrate probable cause before they could target an individual with it?
Yes. And we know that DPS has stingrays. You know, law enforcement in Texas do use this type of technology, and they do need a warrant to use it.
You broke this story.
Right, yeah, me and G.W. Schultz.
How did you first get information about this?
Well, G.W. discovered it through a Freedom of Information Act request. Or, you know, he was actually, first off, he was looking through state purchase records. That's how he found it. G.W. worked for the Center for Investigative Reporting for many years and sort of specializes in technology and surveillance reporting. That's really his specialty. And so he immediately saw those purchases and saw the name of the company and knew what it was, because he's been reporting on this types of technology for so many years. And then from there, we filed a Freedom of Information Act with the National Guard to try to get more information about what they were doing with this surveillance technology.
And when you ask the Texas National Guard these questions about how they're using this technology, what do they say?
They did not answer. They just sent us a sort of a boilerplate written statement. We tried repeatedly to get a spokesperson on the phone from the National Guard just to sort of even talk broadly about how they would use the technology and under what circumstances, but they declined to make somebody available.
Melissa Del Bosque is a reporter for the Texas Observer. She reports that the Texas National Guard is using digital surveillance technology that is snooping on innocent Texans without warrants or oversight by the Texas legislature. It seems like every day there is a new revelation, an accusation about sexual harassment and abuse of power by someone in politics, entertainment, and in the news industry. But not everyone who commits these acts is a Hollywood mogul or a household name. As Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides tells us in this commentary, it happens every day in plain sight.
On a late night flight from Nashville to San Antonio in 2016, a rough landing prompted me to put my hands on the back of the seat in front of me. The man seated next to me grabbed both hands with his and whispered in my ear that I should not let go until the plane came to a stop. He kept whispering, "Don't let go, baby." I sat in the middle seat of that row, and the woman on the other side of me looked on smiling, probably thinking that the genial old guy merely comforted an anxious passenger. I'd be surprised if this man wasn't already in his early 80s, but I'm not sure. When we'd boarded, I'd seen him at the gate, that he had trouble walking, and that the knuckles on his hands seemed outsized, arthritic. On the plane, he regaled me with stories about his childhood, medical school, his work as a doctor, his love of nurses, and the disintegration of his marriage. At one point, he said he likes Mexican girls. Finding the comments inappropriate, I disengaged and stared straight ahead. But by this time, I'd answered the few questions he'd asked me during his monologue. I told him exactly three things. I'm married, I have a daughter, and I also told him the name of the university where I teach. Seeing the lights of San Antonio from the window, I felt eager to get home to my family, but more eager just to get away from this man. and that's when the plane swayed enough to startle an old latent flying phobia of mine. When he grabbed my hands and pulled them toward him, I froze. I knew instinctively not to make a fuss, not to do anything that would raise a ruckus, not on an airplane. Suddenly, this feeble old man with the gnarled hands and a slow gait seemed to have superhuman strength. He pulled so hard that the only way to extricate myself would have been to make a scene, to scream, to stand up and run away. But we were landing. I felt paralyzed. One hears about such things occurring, such situations, when we think about our plan of action, what we would have done, how we would have avoided being the target of such an offense. But in that moment, the paralysis is also in the throat. There are no words, and the silence screams inward. I couldn't hear what else the man said after that. I could only see his lips moving, smell his terrible breath, feel it on my neck. I couldn't hear what the pilot was saying about the weather. I couldn't hear the weary flight attendants muttering their gratuitous canned farewells. I couldn't hear the grumbling protests of the other passengers as I pushed my way through to retrieve my carry-on from the overhead bins, pulled on the overstuffed case with an undue force that pushed me backward into a row of seats on the other side of the aisle. Didn't hear anything as I dragged the case, not even adjusting it so it rolled on its small casters, just dragged it up the length of the jetway until I arrived at the gate, mercifully empty at that late hour of the night. I imagine someone listening to what I've described here might consider it harmless, a non-event. I've shared the story with people who offered their imagined scenarios of quick-witted retribution had they been in my shoes. I would have screamed bloody murder, they say, or I would have broken his fingers. How easy for them to imagine that one can just slap a fresh masher across the face like in some old movie, but it's not that way. Situations like this are traumatic in themselves. But they also trigger other traumas, past events from years ago. Other times, out in the open, in plain sight, in schools, shopping malls, movie houses, in offices, churches, and in volunteer roles. Any place you imagine is safe. In the days following this event, the old man called me at my office at the university and left messages saying he would be coming to San Antonio to visit me at my campus. He called every single day for several weeks. Maybe the calls were a way for him to continue his harassment. Maybe he hoped I would never answer and he could keep calling daily knowing he was tormenting someone on the other end. Inexplicably, I was not able to pick up the phone to tell him to leave me alone. I was not able to lift the receiver and, without offering a greeting, just sternly say all the things I once imagined I would say before this ever happened to me. Those innocent, oblivious times when I thought I'd know just what to say to fend off such a violation. Back when even I thought I could, as one person admonished me, just get over it. One day last spring, when the number with the California area code flashed on the screen, something moved me. I'm not sure what. Feeling fevered and chilled at once, purposeful and afraid, I answered the phone. I picked up the receiver and said, "Don't ever call here again." I could hear the man saying, "What did I do?" as I hung up. And he never called again. Did he really think he hadn't done anything wrong? That's likely. But he had invaded another person's space, restrained her, said those things he said, broke something, cracked it open, leaving a pain red, slow healing scar, uneven and misaligned, like a forced smile. I imagine him holding his phone, sitting there, incredulous, stunned, mouth agape, and deaf to the truth.
Yvette Benavides is a contributor to Texas Public Radio. She's a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.